Okay, so then I can go.
People will take their seats, please, and we'll get started as soon as Mr. Computer and
what you did for it.
All of that gets taken care of.
Oh. Happy to help. We'll figure it out.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is Wednesday, January 17th, 2007, and this is the very first meeting of the Public Safety Budget Division for this biennium. I am State Senator Linda Higgins. I'm from Minneapolis, and I'm going to chair this division this year. I would like it if we could all go around the room and introduce, around the table and introduce who we are and where we're from, and so that people in the audience know who's here working on the public safety issues. Senator Moi, why don't you start?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mi Moi, and I represent Senate District 67, which is the east side of St. Paul. I'm also chairing the Judiciary Committee, which is the policy committee, I guess, that comes along with this budget division.
I'm State Senator Linda Berglund from South Minneapolis, and I have served on this committee in the past.
I'm Senator Ron Latz from St. Louis Park. I've not served on a public safety committee in the past, but I was in the public safety division of the Attorney General's office for 5 years, and I've practiced law on both sides of the public safety fence in private practice. So.
My name is Ken Backus, and I'm the counsel for the committee.
My name is Chris Turner, and I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee.
My name is Nikki Mabry. I'm Senator Higgins' legislative assistant.
Thanks. Alice Seifert, committee administrator for Senator Higgins.
Senator Leo Foley, and I guess I've been on this committee for 10 years, and hopefully I'll learn something. But I represent District 47, which is Coon Rapids, Champlin, and Brooklyn.
My name is Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen. I represent District 11. Counties of Todd, Douglas, Grant, and Stevens. This is my first day. My background is 34 years law enforcement, the last 16 years as Douglas County Sheriff, and retired for 2 weeks now. So looking forward to it.
Senator Rosen.
Oh, good afternoon. I'm sorry I'm late. I'm Senator Julie Rosen, District 24, five counties in southern central Minnesota. So it looks like I'm the only southern representation down here, but very glad to be on this committee. Thank you.
And then Senator Neville is also on our committee, and I expect he'll join us here in a few minutes. Members, I want to remind you just of a couple of things. The microphone system can pick up as you sit back and have conversations with the person sitting next to you. And just remember that other people will be able to hear those if they're sitting in their offices or listening on their computers. If your cell phone is sitting here at the on the table like mine is, if it starts to vibrate, it'll get caught through the sound system as well and annoy the heck out of everyone. And then the third thing to remember is please don't go cranking your microphones back and forth. They break the wires, and so leave them sitting this way and just working around them.
I just leave mine where it is.
Very carefully, you can bring it back. Sergeants will like you if you just leave it where it is. Today we're going to have, there are a couple other people who didn't get introduced. We've got some staff here over toward the side that I think most people can see.
I'm Sarah Kepple-Johnson, I'm the committee.
Kent Hartley, Minority Research.
Megan Johnson, Majority Research.
Okay, and Senator Neville. Say hello.
Good afternoon, Senator Neville from Northfield.
Okay. We have two departments today who are going to give overviews of their jurisdictions. And first, we'd like to introduce and welcome Commissioner Michael Campion from Bureau of, from Public Safety.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. If this is your first meeting, I must be the first witness. It's quite an honor. But thank you very much. Madam Chair, the committee members, Michael Campion is my name. I am the Commissioner of Public Safety. With me today at the table is the best Deputy Commissioner in Public Safety, Mary Ellison, who will provide a bulk of the testimony or overview today. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you. We will try to provide you a concise and informative overview of public safety. What is the Department of Public Safety? Certainly every department and most entities in the world have a mission statement. Sometimes they're bantered around at kind of frivolously, but I can tell you that well before I arrived at Public Safety and since I have come in, which will be 3 years in April, the mission of Department of Public Safety has been something we've tried to ingrain in all of the employees and in all of the work that we do. It is the compass by which we try to direct the activities of public safety, and we try as hard as we can to instill that in all of our employees. Very simply, we have the obligation, I think, statutorily to protect citizens throughout the entire state of Minnesota, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And we do take that very, very seriously, and I think you'll understand after the overview why it is important to have a mission statement that that certainly is important and descriptive as we have. When our employees watch the news at night, they see stories about identity theft, fire deaths, traffic fatalities, crime scenes, other kinds of crimes throughout the state of Minnesota, victimization, terrorist threats, and the such. And those activities are viewed differently by the public safety staff because it is part of our culture to protect citizens throughout the entire state of Minnesota. So those activities are taken very seriously by us. The 2008 and 2009 base budget, very quickly, our biannual budget is a little bit more than $515 million a year. A third of that comes from the general fund, slightly less than a third of that is from the trunk highway fund, and the remaining portion is special revenue fund. When you examine the $515 million, 95% of it is spent in the following three ways. Of the 1,933 employees in public safety, 49% is compensation for those employees and their expenses. The second is operating expense, which is about 28%, which includes rent, fuel, and the such to keep the various offices operating and vehicles on the road. Lastly is the local assistance, which is mainly grants to local units of government, which is 18% of our entire budget, or approximately $95 million for a two-year period of time. Backing up very quickly, there are, I think I missed one part, and that is that the Department of Public Safety is funded through both the Department of Transportation and this particular committee. So we're going to give an overview of the entire Department of Public Safety, both in transportation and this committee, to give a basis for what all the entire activity is that we do here in public safety. With that, I will turn it over to Mary Ellison, the Deputy Commissioner.
Thanks, Commissioner. Welcome to our committee, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, and I wanted to mention that we do have some of our, not all, but some of our division directors here today, and so I just wanted to point them out because I know there are new committee members. We have a few new faces, so I wanted to point out Tim Leslie, who is our Assistant Commissioner in charge of our law enforcement activities. We have Superintendent Tim O'Malley, Superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We have Colonel Mark Danaski, who is Colonel of the Minnesota State Patrol. We have Ron Whitehead, who is Director of the 911 Armor Program. Dan Boydum, who's Assistant Director for our Finance and Administrative Services. We have State Fire Marshal Jerry Rosendahl here in the back of the room. Chris Eide, who's Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We have Mark Shields, who is behind the screen. He's Director of our Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. Jerry Bovera, who's Director of our Office of Justice Programs. Janet Kane, who's Director of our Office of Technical Support Services. And Karen Ellert, who is Director of our Legislative Affairs Program. I think that's all we have here today. As the Commissioner mentioned, we're one of the agencies in state government that has the pleasure of having our budget reviewed in two separate committees, both in the House and the Senate. But we're going to give a brief overview of the whole department and then certainly focus in on the agencies that you have jurisdiction over and answer any questions that you have today. The divisions in the transportation area include the Minnesota State Patrol, the Office of Traffic Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, Administration and Related Services, the State Fire Marshal Office of Pipeline Safety Division. The Minnesota State Patrol, hopefully you are all familiar with the State Patrol and not too familiar with it as you drive the Minnesota roadways. The mission of the patrol is to protect and serve all people in our state through assistance, education, and enforcement. provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. The Minnesota State Patrol has an annual operating budget of over $70 million for fiscal year 2007. Also, I would just point out, this is the time of the year when we're giving overviews based on the 2007, so that's the current base budget. But next week, of course, the governor will release his budget proposals for the 08-09 biennium. So not all the numbers that you'll see today match up with what will be in the 08-09 biennium. So I just want to point that out. The numbers we're talking about today as we go through each division are based on their current operating budgets. So the State Patrol has 782 full-time positions. Of their funding, $67 million comes from the Trunk Highway Fund, $2.8 million from the general fund, and $92,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Minnesota State Patrol services include the aviation section, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, drug recognition experts, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, the training academy, radio communications, and a special response team. Driver and vehicle services, this is another division where most everybody in the state who is an adult over age 18, younger, has some interaction every year with the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services. They're funded through the transportation section, as I mentioned. The mission is fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and business partners. DVS has an annual budget of approximately $45 million with 512 employees, and DVS generates $1.1 billion in state revenues annually. DVS is funded by the Special Revenue Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. DVS services include title and registration of vehicles, auto dealer licensing and inspection, prorate services for truck drivers, driver exams, driver compliance, driver's license issuing, public information center. We handle hundreds of calls every day, operations support, and e-business. Another area in the transportation division is the Office of Traffic Safety. The mission of traffic safety is to provide leadership and resources to reduce the number and severity of traffic crashes in Minnesota. The goal is to drive down the number of deaths and serious injuries as low as possible. The Office of Traffic Safety receives trunk highway funding totaling $324,000 a year. That's a required match, which allows the division to leverage $20 million in federal funds annually. The Office of Traffic Safety supports traffic safety outreach, impaired driving programs, occupant protection programs, data systems, safe communities programs, the motorcycle safety support program, enforcement of underage drinking laws, crash outcome and data evaluation, and fatal analysis record system. Administrative and related services include our Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, our Fiscal and Administrative Support Area, and our Office of Technology and Support Services. Also within the divisions in public safety that are funded through the transportation divisions in the legislature is the Office of Pipeline Safety. Several years ago, that was merged within the State Fire Marshal Division, which is funded in the public safety area of our department, but the pipeline safety is still funded through the transportation area. The Office of Pipeline, or the Fire Marshal Division, has a mixture of general funds and special revenue funds, as well as federal funds. What we'll be talking about more now when it comes to the Fire Marshal Division is last year the legislature passed language that created a Fire Services Advisory Committee, a fire safety account, and the Fire Marshal Division will now be funded through that account for the upcoming biennium, and we can spend some time either today or in the upcoming meetings that we'll have talking about the biennial budget explaining how that will work. Fire Marshal services include investigation, enforcement, regulation, emergency response, data collection, and public education. Pipeline safety, as I mentioned previously, its purpose is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. Pipeline safety, most of their funding really comes from revenues that are paid by the pipeline industry. So they have a special revenue fund of $1,014,000, and then that's matched with the pipeline services include pipeline inspections, major pipelines projects, pipeline incident investigations, enforcement, and damage. Our Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, the mission is to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state's liquor laws, and monitor state tribal gaming compacts. The total budget for the Alcohol and Gambling Division is $2.4 million. The alcohol enforcement area has appropriated $778,500, and that's divided between general fund, special revenue fund appropriations from the Indian compacts, and criminal background fees and gambling dollars. Gambling enforcement is appropriated $1.648 million, divided between the general fund, special revenue fund appropriations from the Indian Nation compacts, background check fees, and gambling forfeiture dollars. On the alcohol side, they focus on alcohol beverage licensing and permits, brand label registration, they investigate alcohol-related complaints and investigations of licensed premises, alcohol promotion and advertising. They actually monitor that. They aren't involved in the alcohol promotion and advertising. They monitor that. Enforcement of underage drinking laws and civil penalties. The gambling enforcement area focuses on licensing of manufacturers and distributors of gambling devices, assure compliance with state tribal compacts, and gambling criminal enforcement and investigation. Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Their mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. The total budget for the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division is in excess of $103 million, but only $2.54 million of that comes from the state general fund. All other funding comes to us through the federal government. They have different field services or different branches within the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division. Field services branch focuses on the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, regional operations, state emergency response resources, training and exercise programs, and volunteer resource coordination. The Homeland Security Branch focuses on critical infrastructure protection programs. They operate the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center, Senior Advisory Council, which advises us on grants to locals, the Grant Program and Local Law Enforcement Terrorism Prevention Program, in the Urban Area Security Initiative Grant Program. And this is a lot of information in a short period of time, and as we go through the biennial budget, we'll be going into all of this information in greater detail. The Preparedness Branch focuses on emergency planning, infectious disease and pandemic preparedness. Minnesota Emergency Preparedness and Response Committee is located in this branch, and also radiological emergency preparedness. The Response, Recovery, and Mitigation Branch focuses on emergency operations, post-disaster recovery programs, pre-disaster mitigation and hazard mitigation grant programs to local areas, and Weather Awareness Week campaigns. Next, we have the Office of Justice Programs. The mission of this program is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist victims of crime. Total budget for the Office of Justice Programs is $64 million a year. 58% of that comes from the general fund, 38% from federal funds, and 4% from special revenue funds. OJP services includes the Crime Victim Reparations Program, which reimburses crime victims for losses that they suffer as a result of violent crime. Crime Victim Justice Unit, which investigates grievances that crime victims have when they feel that they've been mistreated by a member of the criminal justice system. Grants to local programs for assistance to crime victims in the areas of general crime, abused children, battered women and domestic violence, sexual assault, and an emergency grant program. They provide training and communication statewide, offer a statistical analysis center on various different issues related to the criminal justice system. In the justice and community grants area, they focus on reducing crime, delinquency, drug abuse, and violence. Next, we have the 911 Allied, the ARMOR program, which is the Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response. Many of you may know that as the 800 megahertz program. Their mission is to provide immediate access from all telephones to critical public safety services and to coordinate the implementation of a statewide public safety radio communication plan. Both of those programs are funded through that we all pay on our telephones, both our landline phones and our cell phones, and that program was appropriated over $40 million in the past year. In the 911 area, the services include basic 911, so routing calls to the right place when people call 911. In the ARMOR area, it's to provide and develop a statewide interoperable trunked radio system from an existing diverse and antiquated analog communications system. The system is designed to be rolled out statewide in six phases. Basically, the system is to ensure that emergency responders coming to the same event can speak on the same radio frequency. Next is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Their mission is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota and to protect the public by providing accurate, timely, and complete investigative assistance, forensic laboratory services, criminal justice information services, fingerprint information, and training to the criminal justice community throughout Minnesota. They have an annual budget of $44.8 million. $41.5 million of that comes from the general fund, $5.4 million from special revenue funds. Federal funds bring in about $1 million a year, and then $361,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund. BCA investigative services include special agents and analysts, predatory offender registration program, the cold case unit, emergency response team, the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, missing persons division, Amber Alert, Internet Crimes Against Children, the Minnesota Crime Watch Program, and law enforcement training. The Forensic Laboratory Services, was there a question?
Yes, Senator Lass.
Thank you. Just the numbers aren't adding up on the slide here for me. The BCA funding says an annual budget of $448 million.
I apologize. Superintendent O'Malley was leaping for joy when he saw that, but it's really $44.8 million. There was a period missing.
Okay. Sorry, so that still doesn't add up.
$48 million? I'm told it's $48
million. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
BCA Forensic Services. We have the Forensic Science Laboratory. We do drug laboratory analysis, nuclear and mitochondrial DNA, Firearms Laboratory, National Integrated Ballistics Identification Network, Midwest Automated Fingerprint Identification Network, Fingerprint Laboratory, Documents Laboratory, Combined DNA Indexing System, Breath Alcohol Testing Laboratory, the Toxicology Laboratory, Trace Laboratory, Crime Scene Service, Training and Accreditation. Criminal Justice Information Services area of BCA offers CrimNet, which you'll be hearing more about as the session progresses, Criminal Justice Data Communications Network, Criminal History Background Checks, Criminal Justice Reporting System, Maintenance and Administration of Criminal Justice Information Systems, Development Services, Fingerprint Services, Technical Support, Training, and Auditing.
I realize that's really a lot of information in a very short period of time. We have the commissioner and I here, and also our directors, if there are questions specifically about any one of the programs at this point.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Engelbrecht.
Madam Chair, question, you said 9/11 fund revenue for 2005 was $40 million off of our telephone?
Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbrecht, I believe it was, I can't remember the number that I said it was, I think it was 2006, it was $40
million. Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
What, Commissioner, was all the money that was gathered through the that same account, that did that automatically go to you, or how does that funding stream work?
Senator Higgins, I think I'll ask Director Whitehead to come up and explain that funding.
Welcome to our committee.
Yeah. I'm Ron Whitehead, the director of the Armor 911 program. If you could ask the question again, I'd try to answer.
The funding that we get, that we pay through our telephone service that goes to the 911 and Armor, does that just automatically go to your department, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the 911 fee goes into a special revenue account and is used to pay the expenses of the 911 program, and then a certain more portion of that's been allocated or appropriated to pay for some of the costs of the armor system, principally for 911 revenue bonds. But it all stays intact in that special revenue account, and that's the only uses that it's applied to.
Do you collect funds from wireless accounts?
Madam Chair, members
well?
Of the committee, yes, we do.
And what about voice over IP?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we do. The FCC had handed down a decision mid-year last year, I think in June of 2005, that did subject the voice over IP telecommunication providers to both participate in the 911 network and did indicate that they had to pay fees. So we have begun receiving fees from Vonage is one of the big providers who's a true voice internet voice over IP provider. They are a bit more of a challenge than the ILECs and CLECs that have to go through the Public Utility Commission, but on the whole, it's pretty well accepted that they have to contribute to the a 911 fee for and connect up to the network.
Thank you. Commissioner Neville? Commissioner.
Senator.
The heck was I thinking? Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want you to refresh my memory. How much is that 911 fee? And I recall, doesn't it decay off after a while when the six phases are built out?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the 911 fee is currently 65 cents. There was a provision in law related to the initial bonding with respect to the metropolitan area. That language was not continued with respect to phase three that was funded in 2005. There is always authority for the Commissioner of Public Safety and Commissioner of Finance to drop the fee back so that it raises enough funding for the appropriated amount based upon what each penny raises on an annual basis.
So we're in phase three of six now?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. We're in the process. In 2005, it was funded. We've sold bonds for phase three, which is 23 counties outside the metropolitan area, and the Department of Transportation is in the process of upgrading towers, installing equipment, and mid-year this year, we should have a good portion of phase three in place and working.
Madam Chair, are we going to get a more of an overview on this later on during the session?
Yes.
I won't ask any more questions. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Commissioner Campion, if I remember correctly, the State Patrol troopers are in the Transportation Division. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
What about the Capitol Security? Are they in that division? Are they with us? Are they with you?
Madam Chair, committee members in the Department of Transportation funding.
They're in the transportation fund, too. Okay. And they, the Capitol Security, are they funded out of the governor's budget? Are they funded out of some special account? Do you happen to remember? Commissioner?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they're funded through the Trunk Highway Fund, like the other areas of State Patrol are. I think there might even be some general fund dollars in there too. But yes, the governor does make a recommendation regarding funding for Capitol Security in his budget.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? If not, thank you for being so judicious with your time. We look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for the time.
Our next overview is from the Department of Corrections.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to have Dennis over there to do the technology. I'm Joan Fabian.
All-purpose guy, isn't he?
I'm Joan Fabian. I'm the Corrections Commissioner. Dennis Benson is the Deputy Commissioner in charge of facilities. And Harley Nelson is the Deputy Commissioner in charge of the field services. So we really appreciate this opportunity to be here. And I know some of you are very familiar faces who have heard this before. And so we're going to quickly go through the highlights to be judicious with your time.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to start out by saying, in case you didn't know, Minnesota is really nationally recognized as one of having one of the best corrections systems in the whole country. And a big part of that is because of the fact that we have a real unique relationship with the local level. And in Minnesota, because most prisoners, or not prisoners, most offenders are sanctioned at the local level, it really gives the most serious offenders go to prison. So we save the prison bed there. But just some statistics to let you know how good we are in this state. We rank 21st in terms of state population and 33rd in terms of the crime rate. We have the 48th lowest in terms of how many people we incarcerate. And again, the reason for that is the fact that at the local level that the corrections departments are very strong, very good, and take care of, sanction most of our offenders at that level. We're the 40th lowest in terms of per capita spending for state and local corrections at $137 per person compared to $192 nationally. And in Minnesota, we have one of the lower recidivism rates. About a third of our offenders released from prison are convicted of a new felony offense within 3 years. And nationally, it's about two-thirds. We still have a ways to go to reduce that, however. The second, we're always comparing, someone's always comparing it, I should say, to us to Wisconsin. And in the area of corrections, I think we really fare well. We have a state population that is very close to, we're very similar in state population, but the number of inmates, it's very dramatically different. There's 22,000, over 22,000 in Wisconsin and 9,000 in Minnesota. And again, that's because of the local level that provides much of the correctional services in Minnesota. We then, on the other hand, if you look at the number of
adult probation, people on probation, in Wisconsin there's about 73,000, but in Minnesota there's over 121,000. Again, the state budget, it's almost $1 billion a year in Wisconsin, and in Minnesota it's half that. As far as facilities, Wisconsin has 36 adult facilities, where Minnesota has 8. And the per capita spending rate, we are the 40th lowest, and they're the 5th highest. Also, the I mentioned the incarceration rate. They rate 26th, and we're second to the lowest. I mentioned the local, state and local partnerships, and prior to my coming to the state 4 years ago, I had spent about 37 years at the local level in Ramsey County, and we really do have a unique relationship. The powers that be for the last 40 years, legislators and other decision makers have agreed that it's better, because offenders do return to the communities, that it's better to sanction offenders at the local level and save the more expensive prison beds for the most dangerous offenders. And our sentencing guidelines are used by the courts to determine who should go to prison. At the state and local delivery systems, we really been working to maximize our resources and promote evidence-based best practices. We have a group that includes the three delivery systems with directors who are, we do training together. We are spending a lot of time trying to make sure that all jurisdictions are using evidence-based practices as the Minnesota way to do business. Harley Nelson, who's our deputy commissioner, will just talk about the three delivery systems.
Okay. Hopefully this slide will give you kind of a clear view of what can be a complicated system. In Minnesota, in 1973, the Community Corrections Act was passed, and a number of counties entered in 1974. Ramsey, Dodge, Fillmore, Olmsted, Crow Wing, Morrison, and so forth were some of the counties that entered early. Later on, in the late 70s, more entered, and we now have in the state of Minnesota, we have 32 counties and 17 jurisdictions that are members of the Community Corrections Act. To be a member of the Community Corrections Act, they will receive a subsidy, so they will then provide felony supervision to offenders and also supervise release to offenders coming out of the adult facilities. You'll notice that the Community Corrections Act counties are in white on this map, and those counties are major larger metropolitan areas. You have to have 30,000 in a county to be eligible to come under the Community Corrections Act. In those counties that are smaller, you will see that they've grouped together, like Red Lake, Polk, and Norman, Rock Nobles, and some of those 6W, Parley, Yellow Medicine, Chippewa, Swift, and so forth. So they group together to get that mass that they need to come under the Community Corrections Act. The rest of the state is the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and in 55 counties, adult felony supervision is provided by Minnesota Department of Corrections state probation parole agents. In 27 of those counties, the state is also contracted out and is doing juvenile and adult misdemeanor services for those counties. That's the county's responsibility. They have the state come in and contract those services, and then they reimburse the state for that. As part of that process, though, they also, which you'll be hearing about during budget time, get up to 50% of a CPO reimbursement for the salaries of those probation officers. In 28 of those counties, the county themselves are doing that service themselves and paying their probation officers and serving the courts. In those 28 counties, they also get up to 50% of those salaries reimbursed. Clear as can be? It's not. It's fairly difficult, and we'll get into more of that in the funding. And amazingly, for a system that's somewhat complex, it has worked very well. And I think while in Minnesota, while there's a Community Corrections Act counties, that philosophy has gone into the other counties also. The CPO counties will often do planning. They'll often have advisory boards. The Minnesota Department of Corrections will work very closely with those communities. So there's an overall philosophy of working and getting the job done in the community. The next slide will give you a little indication of what the numbers are. 131,000 on probation in Minnesota as of 12/31/05. That number is growing, not as fast as it has been growing in the past, but it still continues to grow. 77% are male, 23% female. Usually at this point, the commissioner comments on the nature that the males are often in more trouble than males, and then the females, excuse me. 89% adult, 11% juvenile. The DOC supervises about 18,560 of that total. The CPO counties who are supervising adult misdemeanors and juveniles supervise another 18,000 to 19,000, giving you 36,000. The Community Corrections Act counties supervise 36,000 of those, or excuse me, 95,000 are supervised in the Community Corrections Act counties. There's an additional 4,000 supervised releasees, members that come out, or offenders that come out of prisons, bringing that total up to 135,000 under supervision in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Institutions Division. We're going to talk for a few moments about the 10 correctional facilities in the state of Minnesota. It's the obviously the largest division just based on the number of staff. About 83% of the staff work in prisons. There are 8 adult correctional facilities, Moose Lake, Willow River, Lino Lakes, and Faribault are medium custody or level 3 facilities. Oak Park Heights is the high custody or maximum custody facility. It's a level 5. Stillwater and Rush City and St. Cloud are all level 4 facilities. And Shakopee is our only female facility, with the exception of 24 CIP, Challenge Incarceration Program, female offenders that are also housed up at the Thistledew Camp, which is up in northern Minnesota. And we also have a juvenile program up there with a very strong meth treatment program that's been very successful. It's been in operation now for a couple of years. But there's sight and sound supervision between those 24 females and the juveniles up there. We also have a juvenile facility down at Red Wing with approximately 130 juvenile males, and we have one cottage of adult males down there, again, sight and sound supervision. So that's basically where the offenders are located. There are roughly 9,000 of them today, 192 juvenile offenders. We'd also point out that we have 10 wardens, and half of those are females, and 33 years ago, I can tell you, not only did we have we had one female warden at Shakopee, but we didn't have females working inside the first gate of our high-security prison. So that has changed dramatically, and I must say a good change.
Commissioner Benson, your slide shows that there's only one girl of the 192 juvenile offenders. When I talked to the various police, they say that the criminals that are out there on the streets these days are younger and more violent, and many more of them are female. But they're not ending up in your system yet?
Madam Chair, the girls are usually, many of them are from Hennepin and Ramsey County, and they go to, in Hennepin County, there is a facility that does take girls at the home school. In Ramsey County, I know just from experience, we do a lot of, they did a lot of group home, placements. The Red Wing facility is used for, so-called worst of the worst of the juvenile offenders, and they're really, we used to send them to Sauk Center, and because of there weren't enough being referred, so that closed out. At this point, we only have one, and they go to Duluth. We do have 6 beds there, 4 girls, if they get committed by the court, but we are, have very few girls that are committed.
Madam Chair and members, this next slide just gives you kind of a retrospective look at what populations have done in the past 6-7 years. As you can see, our growth continues. We've had some growth spurts back between 2001, 2002, 2003, 4, and then between 4 and 5 and 5 and 6, it started to slow a little bit. That's the good news. I guess the bad news is there is still growth. It just isn't quite as steep as it has been, but populations have increased about 83% in the last 10 years. It's almost doubled in the last 11 or 12 years. So we have spent a lot of time just trying to accommodate that growth. The female are indicated on the top a piece of that bar that's in maroon color there, a little bit still growth, a lot of growth, but not as as dramatic as the males, just in terms of numbers. Percent probably at least as dramatic. I think in 1986 we opened Shakopee with 132
beds, 93 offenders.
At Shakopee today, we're about 550, so pretty dramatic increase. By the way, I'd like to introduce Rick Hillengass, who is the warden of the Shakopee facility. He's going to be spending some time with us this session. Every year we try to bring a warden down here and show them a really dangerous place and try to educate them on what we go through from January till June.
Well, welcome. We look forward to working with you, too.
Madam Chair and members, this next slide indicates the population projections. This is going forward, and again, I would caution that these numbers are based on current practice, current policy, and current laws that are on the books. Again, the growth is continuing, but not as dramatic. The numbers between the years at the bottom of the chart indicate roughly 250 a year. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but I would suggest that you put four of those years together. That's about 1,000 beds, and in our mind, that's another prison. So the growth does continue at both the male and female level, but the dramatic growth has subsided a bit.
This next slide really is to show what the factors have been in that growth. And basically, it's the drug offenses and sex offenders growth that has spurred that that increase. And if you start from the bottom, we're looking at a 10-year growth. The bottom line shows the number of sex offenders, was about 1,092 back in 96. And in 2006, it was over 1,500. The yellow line is the drug offenses. And as you can see, it has increased 285% in 10 years. And up in 2001, we have 230 in the blue line, shows the number of meth offenders that came in. And in 2001, we had 230. But by 2006, we had over 1,000. So that is one, certainly one of the factors that, or both of these are factors that have contributed to the growth.
Madam Chair and members, this next slide just underscores the bonding projects that are currently underway. Not all of them are fully funded yet. The Faribault project, we have two phases that are funded. There's still a third phase to be funded. Thus far, we've got in 2005, we U-bonded $89.5 million, and last year another $27.9. We have one more K building of 416 beds to bring the total capacity of that facility up just over 2,000 beds while only adding 40% more staff, about 1,000 new beds. Currently, the population there is about 1,100. So the other things that we're adding down there, of course, are the healthcare remodel, essentially an old folks home or a managed nursing care facility, and a new power plant. We also have a new kitchen down there that's been bonded. Stillwater, 150-bed segregation unit that was bonded last year, $19.5 million. Plan on opening that, I believe, sometime late this next year. Shakopee, we bonded a 92-bed addition for $5.3 million in 06. At Lionel Lakes, there was a small healthcare renovation for $2.4 million. the Challenge Incarceration Program, which you'll hear a lot about this session. We've got a research project that has been completed. It's available on our website. But it indicates very encouraging recidivism statistics. The commissioner will chat about that in a moment. But we are we bonded some additional dollars, $2.35 million, to double the capacity of the CIP program. And I believe we're also scheduling a tour up there at some point. So we bring it from 90 beds for men to 180 beds. Red Wing, we got planning money of $623 million for a new education building that's been on our bonding list for many years. Another issue that's important to this committee and certainly important to us is the chemical dependency issue in the prison system. About 85% of all offenders are either chemically abusive or chemically dependent. Today we have about 795 adult treatment beds in our system, inpatient treatment beds for anywhere from a month to 9 months to a year of treatment. By the end of 08, that number should be up around 1,000 inpatient treatment beds. We're very fortunate to have that many beds in a system our size, but as you can see by the numbers, it's very necessary. Long-term treatment with this population is absolutely essential. The CD education and the very short-term 28-day programs just don't seem to work with this kind of recalcitrant population. In 06, we had 1,200 treatment completers. Treatment success, of course, is very contingent on willingness to participate, mental illness issues, bed space, and all of those additional drivers. We added this provocative photo. We want to underscore the kind of problems that the meth epidemic has brought to prison just in terms of health care costs. It really has exacerbated our dental bill every month.
I'll bet. Senator Berglund, you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair and Deputy Commissioner Benson. I was surprised to receive a letter this year from an inmate who is in a bed that's leased by your system at the Prairie Correctional Facility. And he indicated that he was sentenced for a DUI felony conviction, and that there was no treatment program for chemical dependency at the Prairie facility, and he very much wanted treatment. I mean, I can understand why. I mean, the way the law works, you can get a shorter sentence if you have a successful completion of a treatment program. So I was surprised that those inmates were being sent to the Prairie Correctional Facility.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, the good news is we now do have a treatment program out there. We asked them to start a program. They just started it. We just graduated our first 24 through the program. So we do have a treatment component at Prairie. The therapists are licensed the very same way that ours are. We audit that program out there, and it's been a very healthy addition to the program out at Prairie Correctional Facility. So it was true that in the beginning we did not have a treatment component. They did have a CD education component, but our experience with that kind of programming is it just doesn't meet the grade for this population. So they have added 24 beds, and we're starting our second group out there now.
So, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner, how long were DUI felonies being referred to the Prairie facility when there was no treatment available?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I can't tell you that. Most of the DUIs that met the Level 3 criteria stayed either at Lino Lakes or were placed in Faribault, where we do have treatment components. So I don't know when you received this letter, but I think we got that program going sometime midsummer. So we've I can't swear that the DUI wasn't placed out there, but the information I have is they weren't routinely placed out there. Unless they were a treatment failure or they refused treatment, then they may have been sent to the Prairie Correctional Facility.
Well, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner, the impression I had was that he was not offered treatment. He had not refused it. He wanted it. And he was trying
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, we'd be more than happy to follow up on that if you can get us a name and we can certainly respond. Obviously, there are more than 24 out there currently that probably are mandated for treatment, so we can't get them all in at once, but I can certainly check out the order of things with respect to this particular funder.
Thank you.
Senator Foley?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Benson, we looked at some geriatric problems the past 4 years or 6 years or whatever I've been involved with this committee. What kind of facilities are you looking at to take up the slack there? I haven't seen any evidence of any bonding request.
Mr. Benson?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, again, I think we've got a plan, and we do have a population that is aging every year, just like all of us, I guess. But our plan is next year, or this year rather, in the phase two bonding package at Faribault, the plan is to renovate the Linden Cottage, which is where we have currently 50 men who are either wheelchair bound, might be blind, they might be paraplegics, they might have some level of dementia. But we really believe that we've got to turn that facility into a managed nursing care facility for those people who can't get into the shower, can't get in and out of the tub. We will have nursing assistants down there, and we're trying to get that number as close as we can to 100. We won't get all the way to 100 because we will have some orderlies living in there too. But then the step before that, what we're planning now, next year when we come back to bond the last K building, Faribault, we're going to take one of those legs of the K. Instead of putting the bunks on top of one another, they're all double bunked, we're going to put them side by side, and that will be kind of the rest home. That will be where the older men who are still mobile, who can still go to the kitchen, who can get their own meal, but they're aging and they might have some minor medical malady, but they're an aging population. And we're going to try to house as many of them in one of those legs as we can. I believe that's 116 or 104 in a leg. So between those two units, and then the other thing that we are talking about is adding some transitional care beds. That would be, you'd start out in the one leg of the K, then you'd go to the managed nursing care unit, and then you would go to the transitional care unit, and that would be kind of an end-of-life place where our older offenders are going now. In addition to that, we have the options of conditional medical release to a DHS facility. Currently, that's located up at Agua Ching. I believe their plans are to move that. The last we heard was down to St. Peter. They are secure beds. But as you know, the day of putting these offenders in community nursing homes, we are very, very reluctant to do that, simply because most of these people that are going to die in prison are either murderers or sex offenders, and the communities are not very excited about that population. So we're trying to build our own continuum of care for this aging geriatric population.
Senator Foley?
Thank you. One more shot. Tell me what's the status of the women and what do you expect as far as requiring additional beds for the women?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, the good news with females, while they're still, the projections indicate they are still increasing, we are bringing on 92 beds, probably in the next 12, 14 months. That should hold us for a while if projections hold, depending on policy changes, sentencing enhancements that could impact on projections. That should, we think, take us probably the next 4 or 5 years. In addition to that, we have the option of adding one more unit at Shakopee, maybe a minimum unit. We are also looking at adding some transitional care beds down there because, again, we have females, too, that are going to be in prison a long, long time. And we also need to add some segregation beds. I think we have less than a dozen segregation beds for, 23. For a population of 550. And our rule of thumb, at least for males, I know is about 10%. If you've got 1,000 beds, you should have 100 segregation beds. So we have to, again, it's the infrastructure. As you've heard me say many times before, it's more complicated than just adding a bed. It's the visiting space. It's the dining space. It's the program space. It's the infirmary space, the segregation space. You've remodeled, I think, two different healthcare units because of expanding population. So those things are going to continue to be on the table as we come forward with our bonding requests in the bonding years that lie ahead. Madam Chair and members, this next slide talks a little bit about our education component. Very important to our department. We, at any given time, we have several thousand offenders involved in some level of education or vocational training in our facilities. In between 2003 and 2006, as you can see, almost 2,500 received their GED, high school diploma. In addition to that, we have vocational programs around printing, upholstery, welding, construction trade, computer literacy, machinists, carpentry, and it's very, very consistent with the direction that we're going with reentry. Commissioner will talk for a moment about reentry here in a moment, but front-end loading these people while they're in the facility with a viable, transferable skill is something that's very important and critical to their success when they get out. Mental health, another area that we've talked about year after year, and again for the new member, review for those that have been around a while, 25% of our adult male, 56% of our females are on some type of psychiatric medication. That's a dramatic increase. 8% of our males and 30% of our females have a major mental illness diagnosis. So over 50% of our juveniles are also on a psychotropic medication. Makes it difficult in terms of all of those things that we've talked about. We've had a lot of success with the release planners that members from this committee, particularly Senator Berglund, was instrumental in funding in years past. We'll be talking about that, too, in relationship to our reentry initiative. But this is something that we have to recognize and deal with if these people are going to be successfully reintegrated into our communities. About 1,750 offenders received release planning services in fiscal year 06. So it's something that we are really pushing forward as a major initiative, is the whole reentry initiative, I believe, and the last 30 years, it's an area where we've fallen short, and we just have to do a better job of helping offenders transition into the community.
Senator Berglund, then Senator Rosen.
Assistant Commissioner Benson, have you done any tracking of the inmates that received a mental health discharge planning and compared the recidivism rate to those before we had the program?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I don't believe that we've compared recidivism rates, but we do have numbers on how many were provided the service and how many failed or didn't fail. It's something we could certainly try to accomplish.
I'd be interested in getting that information.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Benson, back to the education, if you don't mind. Would you rather save these questions till later, or should we finish up? I just had a couple on that last section.
You're on a roll. Go right ahead.
I am on a roll. The adult offenders without their high school or GED must participate in literacy programming. Are they tested when they come in to see if they can read? Because what I have read and been to various seminars and conventions and that type of thing throughout the country, that the literacy is a huge component in their reentry issue and their ability to accept and absorb
Madam Chair.
Rehabilitation.
Commissioner.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, yes, they are. Every inmate that comes into our system is tested, and they go through a variety of assessments. We do a mental health assessment. We do an incompatibility assessment. We do an educational assessment, a sex offender assessment if it's called for, and a chemical dependency assessment as well. But education is one of the first ones that we do next to incompatibility when they come in to St. Cloud, which is our reception center. And those people that don't read at, I believe, the 10th grade level, we require that they get enrolled in GED. If they don't, they get stuck at a certain pay grade in their job. People, for instance, that work in MnCOR, our prison industry, they're stuck at, I believe it's a second or third step. They can't advance unless they agree to participate in evening GED or literacy training. So there's an impetus there to get them involved and to try to get them at least increase their level of reading and skill in that area. And if they've got the time, get their GED. We've had a very, very successful program. Most prisons now have gone to the tutoring method, and it works very well where inmates are tutoring offenders in our facilities, and it's been very successful for us. So we've had a lot of success. Again, the numbers are, for a small system, over about 2,500, I believe, received their GED in the last 3 years, so that's pretty remarkable.
Commissioner Benson, I had a question. What are you testing them to see what they're incompatible with, being incarcerated?
They're
Madam
all
Chair,
incompatible
yeah.
with that.
One of the challenges, again, the same kind of gang friction that you read about every day in the newspaper on the streets occurs in our cell blocks. And we have a responsibility to try to provide a safe environment for these people to do their time. So we have to know of any incompatibilities with other offenders that they might have. If they're from a street gang, they may very well have problems with offenders who belong to another street gang. So we would take that information and strategically place them somewhere in our system, or at least separate them into a different cell block. And we've managed that. We have what we call an incompatibility system that is very sophisticated. And when we get that information, we work hard to keep them out of harm.
Okay, thank you. Senator Rosen, another question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, or Deputy Commissioner Benson, 85%, did I read that, of the adult offenders assessed need CD treatment while incarcerated? That's a tremendous amount. Are you at some point going to go through what the plans for the department are to increase the treatment outside of the SIP program and what you're doing as far as assessing those inmates as far as their mental illness and besides their...
Madam...
Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, yes, we will certainly be getting into that in some detail in our budget presentation. Again, the good news is we do have 800 inpatient treatment beds. We're in so much better shape than most systems out there. By the end of 08, we're going to be at about 1,000 inpatient treatment beds. We're also trying to turn all of our minimum custody living units, which we have four in the system, into CD treatment aftercare, to try to create a sober house environment. So they are treated, they go to minimum, they learn how to live sober, and then they're released back into the community, which would be a component of our reentry initiative as well. Getting the treatment is one thing, but learning how to live a sober life is something very different. And it's also difficult if you get the treatment and go back to cell hall B. It just doesn't work. It's also difficult if you get the treatment and go to the streets without some, I call it sober house living, and that's what the major treatment centers are moving to, 30 days of primary treatment and then 6, 12, 18 months of sober house living. And they've experienced a lot of success with that model, and we're trying to duplicate that. But yes, we need a lot more CD beds. They're very expensive. But I think if we can treat or release people treated, it will go a long ways to reducing recidivism as well. This next slide is just talks about our MinCorp industry program. We're in our fourth year into breaking even now. We operate 66 different business partnerships. Any given year, we employ about 3,000 offenders at any given time. It's somewhere around 1,300 to 1,500. I call it the backbone of our programming. This program teaches people not only transferable skills, but in many cases, it teaches people just how to roll out of bed in the morning and go to work. Some of those basic perfunctory work skills that this population never got or has. We have a lot of turnover, but it really is cheap security for the correctional facility. Wake them up in the morning, put them to bed tired at night. It goes a long ways in terms of managing the correctional facility. And this program has really helped us drive down our idleness rate. We have one of the lowest idleness rates in the country as well. And that's something that's very important to managing those correctional facilities. Senator Neville and I go back about 11 years, and we had a conversation about prison industry and could we ever break even. And when he is done being a legislator, I owe him a lunch because he told me you can do it, and we have broke even. Even now for years. And not only that, but we're actually making a dime or two, and we're adding business units that I think really do provide for that those transferable skills. We have a print shop up at Moose Lake Willow River where people are actually putting together resumes, and we're in partnership with the print community where they're hiring these people coming out of facilities. So we've got some good front-end loading, too, in terms of vocational training people, putting them to work in MinCorp, and then we have a placement position, too, that we've just added. We call it Employ, and we'll be talking more about that throughout session that helps the offender get a job.
Okay. Senator Berglund?
Well, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Benson, I have always believed that this program should be making money. Breaking even isn't good enough for me. And I say that because, you know, I took you out to look at the productive day program at the Hennepin County Correctional Facility, and they make money. And they have the people in the correctional facility at Hennepin County an average of 46 days. You have people a lot longer than that, and so the type of productive day work that you could be doing should be able to generate more revenue than the Hennepin County program, because they have such a shorter time to do any training.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I think we're on our way to doing that. Last year we made about $600,000. Today we're at about $1 million, but we've got, you know, 5-6 months left. I don't know, the profit goes up and down with the months, but remember now, we went from, and I'm not making excuses, but 10 years ago we got a $6 million subsidy because we used to believe that this was part program. And we've shed that thinking, and we're moving ahead. And we have some dynamics that I would suggest are a little bit different than the workhouse. And I have looked at that program very closely, components of it. We have a major, major turnover issue. We have security issues that I think are unique to an adult correctional system that they don't have to comply with at the local level. So there are 300% turnover. We have six counts a day. Our work day is about six and a half hours with the counts and the meals and controlled movement. And the other challenge we have, we do about $40 million a year in business, but for instance, 5-6 years ago, we were going to get into the residential dock business, and we were set up to do that. We do docks for DNR, and we've been very successful. But then we have somebody that goes to their legislator, cries foul, unfair competition. So we have to be very, very diversified. We're in a whole lot of different businesses that are really kind of targeting public sector in terms of furniture production. Printing, for instance, is another one. Signage, sign making. So we're all over the map in terms of those 66 different business units. And there just aren't that many companies out there that manage 66 different businesses and try to break even. If we could do just docks or just furniture, we don't have a state use law here, and we really don't want one. We think we're better off trying to win customers, and that's been our philosophy. But again, I can bring you or data that will show you that over the years, our profit margins have gone up. So I think we're on the same page. We certainly don't dispute that we should make money. I don't think we're ever going to make $20 million. But you know, we're going to make a little money, and that money, we're going to introduce legislation this year that allow us to use anything that we make to help us with things like the reentry initiative that are really important.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner Benson, this employee that you launched last year, is there a relationship between the Department of Deed and the workforce centers?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, in fact, we've got another piece of legislation that is going to allow us access to the deed database. So, yes, there is a relationship between our office and that agency. We're working closely together to try to tap into data to assist in our initiative of employing more offenders.
Okay. Commissioner Benson, there was a legislative auditor's report recently about MNCOR. Could you give us the highlights of that for those of us who weren't paying attention, like me?
Madam Chair and members, I can speak to those issues that I can remember. I did not bring the report today, but the one issue was the disposition of some farm machinery. We didn't do that as properly as we could have or should have. We were in the farm machinery business from about 1918, I believe, up until this past year. We had parts inventory. The average age of the part was 30 years old. This stuff should have been written off the books many, many years ago. I think the rule of thumb is 5 to 7 years, write it off. Because we were decentralized back before MNCOR, every institution had their own little fiefdom. Then we centralized MNCOR. Then we had the break-even challenge, and the hit we took on the books when we wrote that off was about $500,000. That's one reason we only made $600,000 this year because of that. So that was one issue. We had staff inside of MNCOR that said we should have disposed of that equipment differently, and to some degree, the auditor agreed with that accusation that we could have worked more closely with Department of Administration to properly dispose of the equipment. We should have put out written notice, taken sealed bids, and it was more of a verbal thing. But the notion that this stuff was worth $500,000, I would submit, is just not accurate. The stuff was very, very old. We were lucky to get rid of it. I don't think we could have taken it to a junk dealer and got the kind of money. We didn't get a lot of money for it. But for us, it meant money because we got more warehouse space. So that was one of the issues. We also had three of our MinCor people. We were in a partnership with a company in Green Bay, and they went out there for an annual training event that they did every year, KI Furniture, where you make the dividers in offices, and they attended a football game. They paid face value for the ticket. The legislative auditor thought they should have paid more because they were in a suite, and it was hard for us to value that, but we did. They paid it back, so that was another issue. And then there was another issue regarding contracting. We subcontracted a product that we produced down at Faribault Floor Soap. We subcontracted the sale of that product to a third party. And we had staff that had previously sold it, thought that that was inappropriate. They looked at that, but I don't think there was a finding there. So the bottom line is there are some issues, and the prison industry statute is, again, based on pre-centralizing MinCor, pre-subsidy state funding. So we have also put together a pretty comprehensive list of changes in terms of statute changes around the operation of MinCor. We've worked very closely with the Department of Finance that we think will clean up these areas.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions before we move on? Okay, go right ahead, please. CIP.
The Challenge Incarceration Program, I think most of you have heard of that, and it's really been very promising in terms of treating chronic meth offenders. And so we're real pleased with that. It's a highly structured, rigorous program that really focuses on intensive inpatient treatment as well as the education and skill building and the military drills that they accompany it. 80% of all of our the participants graduate, and you hear about the boot camp, but I think part of the fact that not only is the intensive 6 months of the boot camp where they have the treatment, but the other real positive part is there's 2 6-month periods following where they receive intensive supervision in the community. And that involves aftercare, and that absolutely is something that has to happen with these chronic offenders, and many drug tests. But it's also, you know, kind of a mini reentry program because they have somebody working intensively with them. They help them find housing. They help them with any kind of family problems. So it's really, that's part of the success. And we recently completed an evaluation that received national attention and had a control group of over 1,500 offenders with similar profiles who didn't go through CIP, and then the over 1,200 that have gone through CIP. And it showed that the recidivism was decreased for those in CIP by at least 32%. It also reduced the cost to the state of people coming back into prison on violations by about $18 million since 1992. So the offender eligibility is defined by the statute. No violent offenders can go in. And as Dennis mentioned, we are doubling that program because it has been so effective.
And members, we're going to be going to visit CIP on Friday, February 2nd. On the back of your agenda is all kinds of places we're going to go visit, and this is one we're very pleased that you're going to allow us to go up and see how that program works.
Good. And I really hope everybody can make it because I think you'll be really impressed, and especially when you talk to the offenders and just see, you know, their take on everything. Harley will do
next program is intensive supervised release. This is a statutory defined program. It requires a one agent every 15 offenders, and usually they match up 2 to 30. Utilizes a broad range of supervision tools, including electronic monitoring, and you'll see GPS, global positioning system that's used. We put all level 3 sex offenders, when they come out of prison, are on for a minimum of 90 days. Some of them are on longer. We're using mainly passive throughout Minnesota. There's certain parts of Minnesota where the active requires very good cell phone usage, and we don't have that every place. And so they are putting them on that. But in addition to that, they're on other types of electronic monitoring, which keeps them at home and the house arrest. And they're checked very frequently, many times a week. They'll do anytime, any part of the weekend or nights, the agents will go to that facility where they're housed. They will come back and double back just to make sure that they don't try to sneak out after. So it's very intensive. About half of them are sex offenders. Half of them are other type of strong-armed robbers and so forth. It's very effective in catching them on technical violations before they start to slip, if they're starting to use drugs, alcohol, if they're starting to violate curfews, or if sex offenders are getting themselves in trouble with the kind of patterns that they had in the past. Those agents are catching them and returning them to prison on technical violation before there's a new offense. Something that's kind of interesting is that it was a kind of a surveillance type of attitude, and you had many of the agents coming in there with that kind of mentality that they were going to do the surveillance and do the cop-like of activity. But what's happened also with the 1 to 15 caseload, with some of the offenders that want to make it, they've started to work with them and help them and assist them in their programming and so forth. And so there's been a little bit of the social work part of the agent has entered into that, where they're working with those offenders to become successful. There was 18 new agents that were funded in 2005. There's 73 statewide right now ISR agents. The problem was, before, we weren't covering all of the state, and we were pushing people through too quickly, and we didn't have enough agents, that there are some people that should have gone on ISR that didn't make it. Those 18 new agents were very helpful in getting us up to that point, but as more serious offenders leave prison, we are probably going to be needing more agents in the future to maintain that 1 to 15 caseload size. The next program is one that we're very proud of, offender house building. This was statutorily created for minimum security, nonviolent offenders to build affordable housing. Most of this has been done in northern Minnesota, northwestern Minnesota, and the rural parts of the state. 243 houses have been built since 1998. There's partnerships with the nonprofit economic development agencies, and it's been very, very effective. The offenders make $1 or $1.50 an hour. They pay restitution, provide some assistance for their family if they have child support, etc. They also have been very successful where they will pursue employment in that community. If they're good workers and so forth, many times they will get hired on with construction crews. Senator Ingebrigtsen maybe has a personal opinion of it, because they were housed in his jail. There was two crews for a number of years housed in his jail, and so he may want to comment on how successful. I know you're not supposed to ask a question when you don't know the answer.
Questions here. How does that work?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Yes, we've had a very successful program over the years. Of course, at the county level, it's been a source of revenue for us as well. But, in fact, I just talked with Steve Nagel this morning from the community who you actually work with out in west central Minnesota. And the housing project has been just tremendous for our area. As you can see, the house on here actually is built in Ashby. That's right in my district. And it's been an excellent program. We have two people that have gone through the program that live in our community now, work for contractors. So two real good success stories there. So, yeah, it's been a great program.
And Senator Neville, I think you were a big proponent of this program.
I think this began when Randy Kelly was probably still here. And it started with about $1 million, more or less. And you just keep recycling it, right? Have you expanded the dollars, or are we still operating on the million?
Madam Chair and members, I believe this program was funded in 1997. Started with $700,000.
Okay.
I think we've added a couple hundred thousand since. But you're right, it's a revolving fund. So we sell the house, the money comes back to us. We build another one, pay the wages, sell the house, the money comes back to us. It really has been a win-win-win. And we are either renting beds at Prairie Correctional or in some of our county jails for these crews. But it does teach, as Harley said, the transferable skills. And these people get snapped up because the labor unions out there are dying for people who have some experience. But it really is another program that fits nicely with our reentry initiative.
Okay. Senator Inkerbredson.
Madam Chair, one more comment. In working with the Department of Corrections, it's been just a great experience. There's been some not-quite-successful stories as well, and those problems are handled on an individual basis, and the Department of Corrections have been great to work with, at least in my particular county, and other sheriffs have said the same thing, of putting those back into the system because they actually didn't work out. So that works out well. It's been real good.
Thank you. All right. I think reentry is the next
item. Okay. Reentry is one of our major emphasis. We're really lucky in Minnesota that I go around the country with and meet with the other commissioners, and you know they're just starting to do programs like we've had in the prisons for many, many years. So the legislature in Minnesota has been real wise in, I think, funding those programs. So we have many pieces in place already, which is not the case in many other states. So, but what we haven't done is really have it comprehensive, and I think that's what we're really trying to do at this point, to include the local communities. Again, with community corrections, there's all kinds of resources at the local level, but it's not as coordinated as it should be. So, and I think nationwide, many, many states haven't done, you know, half the things we've done. So they're working on that at this point. But they look at two-thirds of the offenders nationwide go back to prison. And so really reentry is something that everybody in the country is looking at this point because of the cost of reincarceration and also the cost to the community if it doesn't work out. In Minnesota, we have about 6,000-plus offenders who are released every year. And as I mentioned, about a third return to prison, and we don't think that's acceptable. So what we have done is brought together, in 2005, we brought together first all of the 10 state agencies. And just as you mentioned, Senator, we had DEED, and we have Human Services and Health and Employment and the courts, all to look at how we can best maximize the resources that are already there and identify the clients that we have we all have the same clients, and to, you know, make sure that we plan for them appropriately. We also applied for and were accepted to the National Governors Association Prisoner Reentry Policy Academy. We're one of five states, and what they're going to do is give us technical assistance to both the local and state level to make sure our program is comprehensive and we are doing the best practices. Senator Higgins, you'd probably be interested in this potential Annie E. Casey Foundation funding. They have come to the state and really have recognized that there's a lot of things going, but they want to add some funding in North Minneapolis to look at how we can get the community involved in a real way that's meaningful and, you know, to not only provide education, but to look at what programs they need. So they're looking at approximately $250,000 coming into that area.
Commissioner, I think I've already had, several organizations who have stopped by to say that they are willing, able, and ready to start working on this issue. And many have been working on it for years.
Right.
And, you know, there's just so much that people need to have done to get them on the right path. And,
absolutely.
And I look forward to hearing more about your proposals as we go on.
Okay. Thank you. I think I'll just go to the next one then.
Okay. I did have one question, though.
Okay.
As the prisoners are getting ready to reenter society,
Is there any sort of domestic violence programming that they go through? I've talked to some folks who have said that one of the hardest things that people deal with is the fact that their families have often moved on. And, you know, if that's what you want more than anything is to see your family again and get back into that, you know, the way it used to be. And, you know, there may be a whole new partner. There are, you know, way different circumstances. And the potential for some domestic violence, you know, is pretty real in some cases. So I'm wondering, is there some programming that they get? Is there some counseling before they make that step?
Madam Chair, yes, there is. And, you know, in the one of the things that we're really improving upon is a case plan for everybody based on the assessments. And I think we were a little lax in that. And since we've been really getting into the reentry initiative, we've really beefed that up. And in many, many cases, part of the plan is because of the violence in their background that they do have to go through training or programming in the prison for that. The other thing we're looking at is when they get back out into the community, there's a number of really fine organizations that do provide that, and those will be things that we look at. Again, the case plan will follow the offender, and, you know, we're looking at every single aspect. And some of it is, you know, reunifying families, but again, you know, that's going to take some time because, you know, many of them have not seen the offender at all while he's in prison. And so all of that will be part of this reentry initiative.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, my question is in regard to the portion of the program that's going to be trying to provide housing for offenders. And I'm wondering if you have a plan for dispersing people that are leaving the correction system throughout the community rather than having them be concentrated in certain parts of the metropolitan area or certain parts of the state.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, that is absolutely part of what we're looking at, and we are working with community agencies also to look at that. But, you know, one of the thing is that they, you know, we can't tell them where they can live, and many of the times they go back to the area that they came from. But I know it's a huge problem, you know, the concentration, especially of sex offenders. You know, and I think, you know, at this point, none of the community agencies are stepping up to want to deal with that. They will take other offenders, but they don't want to have anything to do with sex offenders. So that is a huge problem, and, you know, we will continue looking at a solution for it. But, yes, we don't want to have it concentrated either. It isn't good for the community or the offender.
Madam Chair. And, Commissioner, I know that you don't have control over where everybody goes when they leave prison, but to the extent that you're going to have a reentry project that's going to be trying to help people locate housing or trying to create landlord contracts, you then have some control over where you try and get that created at. And that's what my question was, really. You do have some contracts with landlords out there now that are in communities that tend to have over-concentration. So I just wanted to try to emphasize the need for making sure we have housing throughout the area.
Statewide contracts for housing.
All right. I think the last page I just wanted to emphasize is that we really have been looking at restorative programs, and from the viewpoint or the vantage of the victim, we have a number of victims or victim family members who want very much to talk with the offender to understand why they committed the offense, to just it's important to them to be involved in that way. So we have at each facility a coordinator that looks at you know, some of these or some of these meetings, that the victim offender meetings, we are very much focusing on trying to make the offender understand the damage that he's caused and some empathy for not only the victim but the community and what they're doing. So I think this is, an area that we're really trying to stress. It's a big part of getting them ready to reenter the community. One of the things that has been unbelievably powerful is A&E Television came and did a documentary on a woman from Minneapolis whose only child was killed. And she wanted to meet the person that did that. So we prepared both sides for this intervention, and they met, and it was very, very powerful. Then they agreed that A&E could tape it. So they've been showing this as a real example. The woman now comes to see this offender regularly. She also got together with the mother of the offender, because they both live in the same community in Minneapolis, and started a organization where the mother of murdered children and mothers of the perpetrators are coming together. I mean, it is just it's just one example of, you know, some different types of interactions that are getting them ready for release. The other thing that happens now is at each of the facilities, they are working to do things for the victims. Again, it's only if the victims want. No one ever forces any kind of, you know, interaction with them. But offenders have earned over $19,000 last year that they sent to victims' groups and organizations. And from anything from walkathons to, you know, recycling pop cans and crafts and quiltings. So there are some real positive things from, you know, and people are changing, and I think that that's really an important thing. Again, you only hear about the really bad people that keep coming back to prison, but, you know, just remember that two-thirds get out and never come back again. So I think that that's really important when you look at the reentry, that, you know, people do change and can change. So with that, I guess I just want to encourage you. I would love to see you come on the tour. I think you really see a different view of corrections if you can be there and meet the people. And I know our staff, it means a lot to them to see that you, you know, do care about the institutions.
Okay. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, you've been really upbeat and positive about, you know, the department and sort of the outcome and where we're at. And so I just want to ask you, are there any problems? Are there challenges? I mean, it seems like everything is going really well, but
we have problems and challenges every single day, but I think the real important thing is we have just really, really good staff, and they know what they're doing, and they do a good job, and sometimes they make mistakes, and I mean, everything is not rosy, but I think it is a really, really well-run system, and I think you can be really proud of it. Did you want a particular problem?
Senator Lance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on Senator Moore's comment, I've heard from people, at least in the Hennepin County community, that there's a feeling that there's a lack of reentry planning for offenders who are coming back onto the streets, and that this is an area that really needs more diligence, more attention, more effort from the department. Such an absence that there were local community people feeling they were going to have to pick up the work because they weren't satisfied that the department was doing enough. So as an encouragement and a challenge to you, I hope that you'll continue to focus efforts on that. I did have a question back on slide number 9 dealing with the increase in the prison population. Sex offenders, drug offenders, and meth offenders. I think I understand the explanation for the dramatic increase in meth offenders. There's just a lot more meth use out there, and But I wonder if you could, I guess, confirm if my assessment on that is correct and give me an explanation for what you perceive to be the other increases. I know at the sex offender offense levels from 2000 until at least through 2003 seemed to be steady, and then there was a pretty big jump there, and I wonder if there was an enforcement change or a statutory change or that would have caused that. Get your feedback on this chart.
Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair and members, if we take a look at history, I'm sure that council can assist here as well, but in the last 15 years, we've had somewhere close to 100 sentencing enhancements, and we got into that period of time where we really nailed sex offenders back in the 2003-04, certainly after the Rodriguez event. Sex offender sentencing increased pretty dramatically. So, you know, there were also increases going back to 1989 that started to drive those sentences upward. And many of those sentence enhancements from even the middle 90s didn't come home to roost until into the new millennium here. So I think it's a result of the long tail on some of those sentencing enhancements that have been very popular beginning back 1989 when we really jacked sentencing up dramatically in this state.
Senator Lutz?
So, Madam Chair, Commissioner, if I'm understanding correctly, it's not that there's necessarily been that many more offenders in these categories each year, but that they're staying in prison longer, and the cumulative effect of the new offenders plus their longer sentences has increased the population in that category?
Madam Chair and Senator, I think it's a combination to some degree, but certainly the longer sentences, I think we saw something in the sex offender report that the legislative auditor did a year or two ago, and it kind of spoke to that issue that there aren't as many more sex offenders in the mix as you would think, but there are a lot more in prison, and certainly that is the result of sentencing policy. But there certainly are more people, too. There are more offenders in prison as well, and they are staying longer, and I think the combination really drives it up. But I think sentencing enhancements trump the number without a doubt. I have to comment, too, with respect to reentry, your comment regarding Hennepin County. Reentry really is a partnership between the prison system and community corrections. And, you know, I think one of our challenges is to really partner with our community partners as well. We can do a lot of things in prison, but then we hand them over to a release agent. So it's incumbent on that release agent, too, to assist with the wraparound services and kind of handing the baton from prison staff to the supervising county or agent. And that's we certainly own a piece of that. We have not done the kind of job that we should have to kind of cement that relationship and get everybody on the same page in terms of what are the things that we need to look at with respect to reentry. So we're more than willing to talk with all of our partners out there and try to address this issue with open eyes, because there's no question that the system has been remiss. But it also comes with a price tag. A good reentry, there are a lot of common sense things we can do, but it's not going to be cheap either.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Benson. So that National Governors Association, that academy doesn't come with any federal funding at all for this issue?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, no, it's just technical assistance. We are putting in for every grant that's out there, though, and our main concern is getting it to the community, because I think that's where the money needs to go to really make it work.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, so if this is an area that seems to be of concern, is there going to be some effort on your part to try to ask for some state dollars to augment that program?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, we are asking for some money for it.
We'll be hearing about that sometime next week, probably. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. And we'll be talking to you, I'm sure, throughout this whole legislative session. Members, we have a few things for you. In your folder, there are actually two other internal folders. Anything you would like to keep, please put it in the save folder, and then we won't clean that out. That's your folder. In the today's meeting, if you didn't already find it, there was the agenda for today's meeting. We put a whole lot of other information for you on this as well. Our next hearing is Monday in our regular time slot. We'll be hearing from Human Rights Sentencing Guidelines Commission and the Post Board. We are also going to be on the road a bit, and next Monday we'll be down at Ramsey County Court in their watching arraignments. And the information, all you need to know, is on here. If you have any other questions, please call Alice Seufert in our office, and she can get you any other information. But we wanted to get you these so you could get them on your calendar. And there's also a flyer for the open house. The Judicial Center across the street is having an open house tomorrow. We're all invited to go and ask questions and see what they have to say. And if there's nothing else before us, we're adjourned, and we'll see you Monday. Thank you.